Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
It's a pleasure of mine to introduce Francine Matthews because I love her work, I love her books, I love both sets, Francine Matthews, Stephanie Barron, and this one, Too Bad to Die, looks too good to put down. So I want to say that she's a best-selling Colorado author, and we are so fortunate to have her here. So please welcome Francine Matthews.
I just have to thank the Tattered Cover, too, because there's no home like the Tattered Cover for any author, much less a Colorado one, and I am so happy to be here. I was explaining to someone the other day that I did my first signing at the Tattered Cover when I was pregnant with my son, Sam, who will turn 21 in November, and it is a privilege to be able to say something like that, and I'm immensely grateful to everybody here and at their branch stores where I've also signed. I also wanted to mention, just briefly, I'm well known for discussing the color of lipstick I used to wear that went with my field camouflage when I was in paramilitary training for the CIA. But tonight I'd like to point out my fingernail polish. It's a color called Gatsby, probably because it looks like champagne silk charmeuse. But to me, it is Goldfinger nail polish, and I personally think it stops bullets. So feel free to examine it when you come up later. Those of you who have read me before know that I love to write about people who actually lived. I majored in history and found it very difficult to tell the truth, so I devoted my learning to making things up about people in particular who had interesting lives. And what generally compels me is moments in those lives that represent gaps in what we know about either what happened around them or what they were doing at the time. I love to fill those gaps with fiction. A couple of years ago, I was researching a book about Jack Kennedy, which is called Jack 1939, and it followed 22-year-old Jack Kennedy during the summer of 1939 as he researched a senior thesis from London to Moscow and everywhere in between. That is a true story. He did do that. And the places he went alone, as Hitler was taking Czechoslovakia and preparing to take Poland, were remarkable, I thought. I wanted to follow that journey and make him a spy for Roosevelt, because we had no spies at the time, and Roosevelt knew war was coming. He tended to tap friends and use them for espionage purposes, and that was the book I wrote about Jack Kennedy. But while I was researching and writing it, I kept stumbling over Ian Fleming. Now, most of us know Ian Fleming as the creator of the James Bond series, and justifiably so. But during World War II, when he was in his mid-30s, he was the assistant to the director of naval intelligence. As such, he was responsible in part for the effort to break Hitler's naval intelligence codes, which are known to us now as the Enigma codes, and which many of us may have learned about by seeing the movie The Imitation Game about Alan Turing. Fleming was an associate of Turing's. He visited him often at Bletchley. And once while he was out there, Turing said to him, "What we chiefly need are pieces of German technology that our troops might stumble across when they've had a raid on an enemy position and they've cleared it out and there are apparatuses left behind. We need those. We need chiefly an Enigma machine, but even a rotor would help us from an Enigma machine." And Fleming left Bletchley, went back to London, and thought, you know, what we need is a commando unit that is trained and dispatched, deployed specifically to pick up German technology and bring it back to Britain so that we can help Turing in this effort. He went about creating and training a unit that came to be known as Ian Fleming's Red Indians. Not politically correct, perhaps, but they did end up being deployed in the field to capture pieces of technology. The other thing he was incredibly adept at was using his imagination to create deception operations. And these were plots, essentially. When you read them, they read like the script for a story, for a Bond film. They are cleverly designed bits of fiction that were intended to attract German interest and misinform them. The most famous of these is Operation Mincemeat. There's a book by Ben McIntyre out that explored Operation Mincemeat pretty thoroughly. This was when the British took a guy who had died of pneumonia and so had fluid in his lungs. They padded his body with false intelligence papers, deposited the body on a beach in the Mediterranean where they expected the Germans to recover it, and thus deliberately fed the Germans misinformation about the location of the D-Day landings. This was something that Ian Fleming came up with. He had other crazy plots that didn't happen, that weren't actually put into effect. He wanted to ditch a RAF bomber in the channel, have the Germans come to recover it, have the crew of the ditched bomber attack the Germans in the boat and steal their Enigma machine. And the Admiralty felt this was just too dangerous, so they didn't do it. But things like this went on. And when I started researching Fleming, I was struck by a couple of things. He was always a writer. He was a writer from childhood. And he had the kind of creative information that seizes moments and spins plots around them. He'd been a failure at almost everything he'd done up to that point. He had dropped out of Sandhurst as a military officer. He had been a failed stockbroker. He had worked as a reporter, which was probably his most successful venture in the late 30s. But it was only when he came to Naval Intelligence that he hit his stride. And it's because he was allowed to lie for a good purpose to deceive the enemy. And he was brilliant at it. He also, interestingly, was sent over by British intelligence to liaise with Wild Bill Donovan when Bill Donovan was creating the OSS. And he helped to draft the original structure of the OSS. And finally, a bunch of his friends ended up working for the OSS or against the OSS, interestingly, as spies in D.C. Among them were Roald Dahl, who wrote Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, and a guy named Ivor Bryce, whom we'll talk about a little bit later. Ivor was a friend of Ian Fleming's from Eton onward and remained his close friend his whole life. And in Too Bad to Die, he serves as a model for a character named Michael Hudson. At any rate, in looking at Ian Fleming, I knew I wanted to write a book about a key moment that he was involved in that was critical to World War II that involved something like a James Bond novel. And I really thought I'd have to make it up, but I started looking at the fact that he planned all of the conferences between Winston Churchill and FDR. And there were a number of these. They started in August of 1941, and they went on up to Yalta. Now, Yalta is the one most people know about, but the one I focus on is in Tehran in 1943, right after Thanksgiving 1943. And it was a critical conference for two reasons. They met to decide the location of the D-Day landings, which would occur, they thought, 6 months later in May, ended up being June. And it was the first time FDR met Stalin. And this was a pivotal moment in Allied relations because Churchill knew Stalin. Churchill mistrusted Stalin. Churchill adored Roosevelt and felt that the bond between Britain and the U.S. was paramount. And FDR recognized that Churchill's day was over, that Britain had bankrupted itself in the war, had spent its forces in two world wars, and would be forever diminished after the war was over, even if they won. Roosevelt recognized that Stalin and he, as head of the United States, represented the future poles of the world order. And he went to Tehran intent upon making Joe Stalin, or Uncle Joe, as he was called in the U.S. government, his buddy. It proved to be an incredibly naive approach, and it was borne out by the descent of the Iron Curtain after Roosevelt's death. But the dynamic that existed as the three men approached Tehran determined so much about post-war Europe and the post-war world. Anyway, I started researching Tehran because I thought, this is an interesting moment. It's the first meeting of the Big Three, and they're deciding D-Day. And as I was researching that, I came across an obituary of a man named Gevorg Vartanian. He was an elderly Armenian man with white hair and a white mustache and twinkling eyes, and he was wearing the highest Soviet intelligence order on his breast. Gevorg Vartanian was 16 in Tehran in 1943, and he worked with his dad running the NKVD cell, which is the Soviet intelligence cell in Tehran during World War II. It's Gevorg who is credited with foiling the Nazi plot to assassinate Churchill, Roosevelt, and Stalin in Tehran in 1943. And he received the highest Soviet intelligence award as a result. I had to write about this. Ian Fleming plans the conference, the Nazis decide to assassinate all three of them, and the Russians foil it. It's a James Bond movie. Now, the interesting thing is where the fiction comes in. Before Tehran, there was a pre-conference in Cairo. Chiang Kai-shek and Madam Chang, Mei Ling, Sung Mei Ling, as she was known. Madam Chang goes, Chiang Kai-shek goes. Ian Fleming is there. But Winston Churchill had bronchitis, and he passed it to the entire British delegation. So his military chief of staff, Pug Ismay, got it, sick as a dog. Ian Fleming got it and was left behind in Cairo. Here's the fictional bit. In my book, I have him using the idea of bronchitis as cover and following the delegation to Tehran, going undercover as a spy named James Bond and thwarting the assassination attempt against the Big Three. The other bit of fiction is that, well, it's not really fiction. It's more a disputed claim. The British have long denied that there was ever a plot to kill the Big Three. And they insisted initially after the war and after the conference that the Russians had invented this whole thing in order to take credit for foiling it. However, FDR implicitly believed he was the target of an assassination attempt and was thrilled because he loved to play at spies. So he eagerly allowed his Secret Service detail to set up a decoy FDR in his personal car, and he took other cars secretly all around Tehran when he had to travel. And he moved into the Soviet embassy to be closer to the talks. This, of course, allowed the Soviets to bug him, which is exactly what they wanted, and is the other reason the British were convinced that they invented the whole story. However, they now claim that Celia Sandys, who is Winston Churchill's granddaughter, on a visit to Moscow, met with Gevorg Vartanian and in tears thanked him for saving her grandfather's life. So who knows? Anyway, these are the kinds of gaps I love to fill with fiction. I have two things I'd like to do, three actually. I'm going to read briefly from the book, and then I'm going to show you some photographs of the principals in the story, because photographs from period stories are always fun, I think. And then I'd love to take some questions. Thanks. One of the difficulties I had when writing about Ian Fleming, as I do whenever I write about an actual person, is I had to find a way into his soul. There are many who would argue he had none. But I don't believe that's true of anybody. And when I start researching them, I look for aspects of their character that are empathetic with my own, or that resonate somehow, or that make sense to me, that speak to me of the complexity of the person. And I try to embrace those and emphasize them in order to inhabit the mind of the person I'm trying to recreate on paper. Ian Fleming died at 56, having drunk himself to death. He looked like he was decades older when he went. He was a deeply troubled man, and he battled depression his whole life. He always felt, it seems, when you study his life, undervalued by his family, and particularly his mother, who preferred his other brothers. He had three, particularly his elder brother, Peter. And finally, he lost his father at the age of 9 in the trenches of World War I. And for the rest of his childhood, his mother had all the boys say a single prayer before bed. "Please, God, try to let me be more like Moki." Moki was the name of the father. And his whole life, he kept the obituary notice that Winston Churchill wrote for his father framed on the walls of his various houses. So in writing about Ian Fleming, I tried to go back to that childhood, and I'd just like to read a brief passage from that. May 22nd, 1917, the Too Bad Club. He learned about Moki the day the new boy arrived. May was utterly the wrong time of year for new boys, of course. There were only a few weeks left before the long vac, which meant there was probably something very wrong with this one. Some reason he'd been shifted to Durnford so late in the term, an infraction so unspeakable he'd been booted out on his 9-year-old arse from the last obscure refuge that had agreed to raise him. The new boy was bony and slight, a pale-faced number with springy tufts of brown hair all over his knobby skull. He had a sharp chin and wide cheekbones, and this, combined with the tuftiness of his head, suggested a young hawk fresh from its shell. The boy's eyes were hawkish as well, winkingly bright, the color of cold pond water. They studied Ian as he stood, ramrod straight and miserable, before the head's closed study door. "Hiya, kid." "Crikey," Ian thought. "A Yank. Are you up for a beating, too?" The boy slouched over, hands shoved in his pockets. "What does he use? Cane or slipper?" "Depends." "On how bad you are?" Ian nodded warily. He had no time for Yanks, who appeared without explanation in late May. His heart was racing as it always did when he faced Tom Pellet's door, awaiting his turn, the methodical swack of a plimsoll on a padded bottom filtering thickly to his ears. TP usually slippered his boys, but he'd been very angry this morning when Ian's Latin grammar was pulled, foul and dripping, from the privy. Ian hadn't tossed it there, but he knew that if he told who had, his head would be stuffed in the privy next. He was afraid TP would cane him. Canings drew blood. His face would crumple and he would disgrace himself. The Yank thrust his shoulders against the wall. "I try to get a beating the first day at every school. It helps me size up the enemy, figure out what he's made of." "TP's a good sort, really," Ian said. "He doesn't beat us for fun. It's for the greater good of England." The Yank snorted. "I don't give a darn about that. How often does he do it?" "Well," Ian shifted uncomfortably, "3 or 4 times a week, but then I'm very bad. How many schools have you been to?" The Yank jingled a few coins in his pocket. "1 at home when I was little, then 2 in Switzerland. I had to leave both of those. And then in Vienna? Gosh, I lost count." "Vienna? You mean Austria?" He grinned. "Good old Habsburg Empire." "You've moved rather a lot," Ian observed curiously. "My dad's with the embassy." "My father's at the front," Ian said. "He's a major of Hussars." "What's Hussars?" Ian scowled. "A cavalry officer. Don't you know anything?" "Not about England." The Yank stuck out his hand. "I'm Hudson, by the way. What's your name?" "Fleming." Although mostly he was called Flem, with a particularly disgusting gob of spittle attached when most people said it. He shook Hudson's hand and hoped his own was not too damp. "Wait a sec." Hudson stared at him. "You're not the grind, the fancy pants everybody's in love with." "That's my brother, Peter. Only he's been sent home. Tonsils. He's 11. The Yank whistled through his front teeth. "I don't know how you stand it. I just got here and all I've heard is Fleming says and Fleming thinks. If I had a brother like yours, I'd slug him. Or change my name." Ian bit his lip. His name was Moki's name, and he wouldn't change it for worlds. Peter's not so very grand, really. Mama says he's delicate. He has to have flannels on his chest and drink nasty tonics. He shall probably be taken, Mama says, because he's too good to live. Grinds always are. I shall live forever, Ian said gloomily. The plimsoll sounds had died away in TP's office. He fancied he heard sniffling, a wet admission of inferiority. It would be his turn next. He closed his eyes and saw a length of rattan hissing through the tobacco fog of TP's rooms. Nobody would dare to stuff Peter's Latin in the privy. Peter would never be caned in his life. My mother was too good to live, Hudson said suddenly. There was a baby, too, but it didn't live either. I expect it was a girl, then, Ian offered. Dad didn't say. He just packed us up and made tracks for England. Ian listened for TP's footsteps across the worn wooden floor. The brass knob would turn with a metallic screech, and there would be TP's face, purple with the outrage of Ian's grammar. We buried my mom there, in Vienna. Hudson's voice was a bit shaky, and his knees were buckling. He slid slowly to the ground. Dad said we had to. Her family's Austrian. Ian whistled. You mean you're related to Huns? Not after this war. Ian rocked uneasily on his heels, too well trained to sit on the floor. It must be terrible to be a Yank with a father who didn't fight, and a mother who was too good to live, but was still the wrong sort after all. Hudson was taking a chance telling Ian about himself. He clearly lived in an appalling state of innocence that would get him killed at Durnford School within the week. Ian thought suddenly that he would have to be Hudson's friend now, whether he liked it or not. He would call him Hudders and show him the best places for tiffin in the village and the best spots for plover's eggs anywhere on the Isle of Purbeck. The door behind him opened. A small boy sidled out, his hands to his backside. His nose was streaming. Ah, Fleming! To Ian's surprise, TP was not grim and furious. He wore a tender expression Ian had never seen before, and the strangeness of it was terrifying. Peter, he thought. Taken. His stomach twisted, and he was afraid he might be sick. Come inside. There's a stout lad. TP scowled at the pile of loose limbs that was Hudson. Get off the floor, boy. I won't be wanting you today. The headmaster moved a pile of letters from an aged club chair and suggested Ian sit on it. He pulled up a hard-backed one himself, his large hands dangling between his knees. TP was beloved for the way he bellowed, Nell! Whenever he misplaced his wife, for his magnificent mustache and spectacles, for his ancient tweeds and his willingness to dive with the boys off Dancing Ledge into the frigid English Channel. He had Tennyson by heart. He was less well-versed in tragedy. There's been a telegram, he said. From home? Afraid so, old man. TP cleared his throat with a noise like gargling. You must be proud, Fleming, very proud. He died for king and country. Peter, with his throat bound up and his special treats. Ian hadn't known it was for England. A buzzing began in his ears, and TP's face blurred at the edges. The buzzing grew louder, and behind it the thud of his heart as he glimpsed the thought at the edge of his brain. The words he must never say. Not Peter. Somebody else. TP was still talking, the same tender look on his face. Ian was going to scream. A hero, Fleming. We must all wish for such a glorious end. Dulce et decorum est pro patria mori. Ian sat rigidly in his chair while the Latin washed over him. He would not think of Moki, who, if he once walked into Ian's brain, would be killed absolutely and forever. Mortar attack, TP was saying. Near Saint-Quentin. Your father meant to take the trench. He'll be mentioned in dispatches, I expect, perhaps even in the Times. You must do your best to be worthy of him, Fleming. Ian felt his throat constrict, his air cut off. He tried to swallow. The headmaster grunted, Good man. Now stand up and take your punishment. Ian got to his feet. He bent over. Six of the best from his own plimsoll. He didn't care this time how hard he cried. Any questions from anyone? Yes, sir. No, I have not. But I would, well, I mean, not Cairo or Tehran, if that's what you're asking. But I say this so often when asked a similar question about even Paris or London in World War II. It is impossible to revisit Tehran in 1943 except through an act of the imagination. So that's equally true of Cairo. I mean, both cities are profoundly different. Even London, when I was writing about Jack Kennedy in 1939 in London, I've been to London a bunch, but present-day London is not 1939 London, partly because of the bombings and the way the city was reconstructed, the way roads are reconstructed. So what I invariably do is try to find maps that are current to the year I'm researching. Another good thing, like I found a serviceman's guide to Iran from the early 1940s, because these were printed up with the knowledge that American and Allied servicemen would be going to a foreign country, that they didn't speak the language, they didn't understand the customs. And you can find these things on used book sites. And they're fascinating because they tell you what contemporary culture was like in the host country, but also there are, if you get a normal traveler's guidebook to a place, there are ads for clothing with prices, there are ads for restaurants, there are ads for hotels. They're wonderful guides to a time you can't recapture by visiting the city. So I find that very useful. Yes? Well, I do the latter. I do the latter. Ian Fleming's family is mostly gone. He only had one child who committed suicide at the age of 22. And he was that child was 12 when Ian Fleming died. His brothers, they had heart issues in the family, and his brothers all died young. One was killed in World War II. So that's not really an issue. I couldn't use the Bond character without permission from the Ian Fleming estate, but that's a different thing. That's an intellectual property issue. I find it interesting, because this question comes up so often about writing about real people. I think it has to do with proximity to the person's time. That's what causes us some discomfort, perhaps, with the whole idea. Nobody questions that Hilary Mantel's Thomas Cromwell is fictional, or that he really lived. But because he lived hundreds of years ago, our sensibilities aren't particularly violated by that. We can watch Shakespeare in Love and know it's fiction and find it totally plausible that someone would write fiction about Shakespeare. If you write about Jack Kennedy, people tend to pause. So I really think it's about time and how much has passed. But I personally find these figures fascinating, and I think they're fair game. Yes, ma'am.
How much time do you spend researching before you put pen to paper?
A couple of months. The question is, how much time do I spend researching before I put pen to paper? And I do spend a couple of months just following various threads that strike me. For example, once I encountered Gevorg Fartani and I started researching NKVD cells, Armenians within the NKVD, SMERSH, which we think of as a James Bond term, but was actually a division of the NKVD that was designed as a counterintelligence unit. They were there to kill traitors to the Soviet Union, and SMERSH stands for death to spies. So certain discoveries will lead to others, and the research has an onion-like character where you're peeling off layers. That said, invariably when I'm writing and I'm in the midst of the story, I will discover that I need to know much more about something like Iranian wrestling, which I hadn't realized was critical until I realized they used, the Allies and the Germans used wrestlers as intelligence sources. So once I sort of stumbled on that, I thought, okay, I've got to learn about Persian wrestling. So you invariably have these moments where you stop writing and you start researching again. Yes, sir, in the back. Sure. He was based in Washington, D.C., at the British Embassy in D.C., and he was there as a naval, Army Air Attaché, RAF Attaché, for Great Britain. And yes, he was a fighter pilot, and he crashed his plane and hurt his back and got a desk job in D.C., but he was really part of a whole unit of British intelligence within the British Embassy in D.C. that was there to collect intelligence on us. And that was prior to the U.S. entry in the war. He was looking at the America First movement and those who were isolationist in Washington, various politicians and newspaper editors and public opinion movers. And then once the OSS was set up, he and others, Ivor Bryce among them in D.C., were liaising with the OSS, but they were still reporting on us. I mean, that's completely understood. Yes, sir.
How did you find and how did the CIA find you?
The question was, how did I find and how did the CIA find me? I have 7 years of higher education and no marketable skill. So I left graduate school without writing my dissertation and could read, could write, and could research. And I married and moved to Washington, D.C., where I'd grown up and realized there were not a great number of jobs for people who could read and write. So I started job hunting among people I knew. And back then, because I'm very old, people had Rolodexes. And people would give you names out of their Rolodexes, and you would call these people, and you were Rolodex hopping, and you never actually met anybody from the Rolodex. You just used their name on the phone. So at one point, I found myself talking to Bill Colby, William Colby, who is a former director of Central Intelligence, Yale man. Gentleman Bill Colby, as he's known at the CIA, because he was a lovely man. And he died very mysteriously. He was found floating face down in the Rappahannock, which, if you're me, got to do something with that someday. But at any rate, he was one of a number of people that week, and it was within the space of a week, who all said, "You really belong at the CIA." And I found this so extraordinary. To me, it was like being told I belonged in a bordello. And I couldn't figure out what it was about me that just screamed CIA, but apparently something did. And so I asked my mother. I called her, and she was very, elderly and Catholic, widowed in Potomac. And I called her, and I said, "Mom, the third person this week told me I belong at the CIA." And she said, "Well, now, Francie, Ann Doyle, whose husband left her for that secretary and flew to Hawaii, she went right over there and got herself a job, and I think you should too." So, believe it or not, the CIA is listed in the blue pages of the phone book, which we again, because I'm so old, used back then. And I called the phone number, and they picked up and said, "CIA." And after a pause, I said, "I'd like to apply." That was it. It's that easy. Even if you're a girl. So, any other questions? Yes, sir.
Can you share with us any other historical people or incidents other than the work of William Colbertson that are kind of percolating with you, maybe something you might work on in the future? Or historical times, or things that might surprise us?
Oh, God, no. Not anything that would surprise anybody. No. I can't. I'm at the moment working on a book about Jenny Churchill, who was Winston Churchill's mother. And again, it's a novel because only biographies have been written about her. And her Americanness, her outrageousness, in a sense, as an American within her milieu, really marked his childhood. And that fascinates me. So I'm working on a book about her. Yeah. Yes, sir. You know, that's a great question. The question is, have I written anything about Ian Fleming meeting Jack Kennedy in Georgetown? And no, I have not, because I haven't written about the 60s, and I don't intend to. That's too close. But I was born in the 60s. But just to give you a quick 6 degrees of separation, what has really struck me in researching both Jack 1939 and Too Bad to Die is how intimately connected all of these people in World War II were. It almost feels as though the people who were running England and the people who were running America were all either related or drank cocktails together, and there were only 10 of them. And I say this because when Jack's sister Kick, who was a character in Jack 1939, was debutante of the year in London in 1938, she was a debutante with Pamela Digby. And she called her a little butterball of a thing because Pammy was overweight before she married Randolph. Anyway, they later became good friends when Kick was Marchioness of Hartington and widowed, and Pamela was a grass widow because Randolph was off somewhere. After World War II, Kick has Pammy to stay with her at Lismore Castle in Ireland, Lismore Castle belonging to the Devonshire family into which she had married the Duke of Devonshire, one of his properties. And she has Jack come and stay too. And Jack and Pammy go off to hunt in the car for the ancestral Kennedy village where Kennedy's ancestors came from. And Kick refuses to go because she is so embarrassed by the fact that her family comes from an ancestral Irish village now that she's the Marchioness of Hartington. Anyway, on this trip, which Pamela recounts, she realizes just how ill Jack is. And when they get back to London, she introduces him to her doctor, and it is her doctor who, for the first time, diagnoses him with Addison's and tells Pamela, "Your young American friend won't see next year." I mention all this because, of course, Pamela knew Ian Fleming. So years later, Jack's a senator. He's married to Jackie. They're living in Georgetown. Ian Fleming is a huge sensation. They read all his novels. Eunice read his novels. And so he's touring the U.S., and Jack uses his connections, British connections, friends in common, to invite him to dinner in Georgetown. And that's what they did. So, I mean, who wouldn't love to be a fly on that wall? Yes. The question is, any chance that Hugh Hefner knew Ian Fleming? Are you referring to the fact that my book got a... Yeah. Playboy chose my book as Too Bad to Die as book of the month for March and gave it a four bunny salute, which I think is just hilarious. Just in time for Easter. Yes, just in time for Easter. So well put. Any other questions? Okay, well, thank you all so much.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.